doorknob, holding the door ajar. Standing tall and erect, he looked directly at Kinderman with eyes that were clear and cool.
"Yes?"
he asked without expression.
"You have the right to remain silent," Kinderman greeted him, his eyes now steely and locked on Carl's. "If you give up the right to remain silent," he intoned rapidly in a flat and deadly cadence, "anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to speak with an attorney and to have the attorney present during questioning. If you so desire and cannot afford one, an attorney will be appointed for you without charge prior to questioning. Do you understand each of these rights I've explained to you?"
Birds twittered softly in the branches of the alder tree beside the house as the traffic sounds of M Street came up to them softly, like the humming of bees in a meadow far away. Carl's gaze never wavered as he answered,
"Yes." "Do you wish to give up the right to remain silent?"
"Yes."
"Do you wish to give up the right to speak to an attorney and have him present during questioning?" "Did you previously state that on April 28th, the night of the death of the British director Burke Dennings, you attended a film that was showing at the Fine Arts Theater?"
"I did."
"And at what time did you enter the theater?"
"I do not remember."
"You stated previously you attended the 6 o'clock showing. Does that help you to remember?"
"Yes, 6 o'clock show. I am remembering."
"And you saw the picture, I mean, the film, from the beginning?"
"I did."
"And you left at the film's conclusion?"
"I did."
"Not before?"
"No, no, I see entire film."
"And leaving the theater, you boarded the DC Transit bus in front of the theater, debarking at M Street and Wisconsin Avenue at approximately 9:20 p.m.
"Yes."
"And walked home?"
"I walk home."
"And were back in this residence at approximately 9:30 p.m.
"I am back here exactly 9:30,
Carl answered. "You're sure?"
"Yes, I look at my watch. I am positive."
"And you saw the whole film to the very end?"
"Yes, I said that."
"Your answers are being electronically recorded, Mr. Engstrom. Therefore, I want you to be absolutely positive."
"I am."
"You're aware of the altercation between an usher and a drunken patron that happened in the last 5 minutes of the film?"
"Yes, I remember."
"Can you tell me the cause of it?"
The man, he was drunk and making disturbance."
"And what did they do with him finally?"
"Out. They throw him out."
"There was no such disturbance." "And you're also aware that during the course of the 6 o'clock showing, a technical breakdown lasting approximately 15 minutes caused an interruption in the showing of the film?"
"No, I am not."
"You recall that the audience booed?"
"No, nothing. No breakdown."
"You're sure?"
"Yes, there was nothing."
"There was, as reflected in the log of the projectionist, showing that the film ended not at 8:40 that night, but at approximately 8:55, which would mean that the earliest bus from the theater would put you at M Street in Wisconsin not at 9:20, but 9:45, and that, therefore, the earliest you could be at the house was approximately 5 before 10, not 9:30, as testified also by Mrs. McNeil. Would you care now to comment on this puzzling discrepancy?"
Not for a moment had Carl lost his poise, and he held it even now as he calmly answered, "No, I would not." The detective stared at him mutely, and then he sighed and looked down as he turned off the monitor control that was tucked in the lining of his coat. He held his gaze down for a moment, then looked back up at Carl.
"Mr. Engstrom," he began, in a tone that was weary with understanding, "a serious crime may have been committed. You are under suspicion. Mr. Dennings abused you. I have learned that from other sources. And apparently, you've now lied about your whereabouts at the time of his death. Now, it sometimes happens.
We're human, huh? Why not?
That a man who is married is sometimes someplace where he says that he is not.
You will notice I arranged we are talking in private, away from the others, away from your wife. I'm not now recording this. It's off. You can trust me. If it happens you were out with a woman, not your wife, on that night, you can tell me. I'll have it checked out. You'll be out of this trouble. And your wife, she won't know. Now then, tell me. Where were you at the time Dennings died? Something flickered in the depths of Carl's eyes, but then died, as he insisted, through narrowed lips. At movies. The detective eyed him steadily, unmoving, with no sound but his wheezing as the seconds ticked by. Then, "You are going to arrest me?" Carl asked in a voice that now quavered. The detective made no answer, but continued to eye him, unblinking. And when Carl seemed again about to speak, the detective abruptly pushed away from the railing, moving toward his parked squad car and the driver, with his hands in his pockets, as he walked on hurriedly, viewing his surroundings to the left and to the right, like an interested visitor to the city. From the stoop, Carl watched, his features stolid and impassive, as Kinderman opened the door of the squad car, reached inside to a box of Kleenex affixed to the dashboard, extracted a tissue, and blew his nose while staring idly across the river, as if considering whether to have lunch at the Marriott Hot Shop. Then he entered the squad car without a glance back. As the car pulled away and rounded the corner of 35th Street, Carl looked at the hand that was not on the doorknob. It was trembling. When she heard the sound of the front door closing, Chris was brooding at the bar in the study as she poured herself a vodka over ice. Footsteps. Carl going up the stairs. Chris picked up her glass, took a sip, and then slowly moved back toward the kitchen with absent eyes, while stirring her drink with an index finger. Something was horribly wrong, like light leaking under a door into a darkened hallway somewhere out of time. The glow of coming dread had seeped further and further into her consciousness. What lay behind the door? She feared to open it and look. She entered the kitchen, sat at the table, sipped at her drink, and broodingly remembered, "I believe he was killed by a powerful man." She dropped her glance to the book on witchcraft. Something about it, or in it. What? And now footsteps tripping lightly downstairs. Sharon returning from Reagan's bedroom. Entering. Sitting at the table and cranking fresh stationery into the IBM typewriter's roller. "Pretty creepy," she murmured, with her fingertips lightly resting on the keyboard and her eyes on her propped steno notes to the side. Staring into space, Chris sipped absently at her drink, then set it down and returned her gaze to the cover of the book. An uneasiness hung in the room. Her eyes still on her notes, Sharon probed at the silence in a strained low voice. "You know, got an awful lot of hippie joints down around M Street in Wisconsin. A lot of potheads and occultists and stuff. Police call them hellhounds. I wonder if Burke might..." "Oh, for shit's sake, Shar!" Chris suddenly erupted. "Just forget about it, would you? I've got all I can think about with rags. Do you mind?" There was a pause. And then Sharon started typing at a furious tempo, while Chris propped her elbows on the tabletop and buried her face in her hands. Abruptly, Sharon pushed her chair back with the sound of wood scraping on wood, bolted up, and strode out of the kitchen. "Chris, I'm going for a walk," she said icily. "Good. Stay the hell away from M Street," Chris shot back into her hands. "I will. And N!" Chris heard the front door being opened, then closed. And sighing, she lowered her hands and looked up, felt a pang of regret. The emotional flurry had siphoned off tension, but not all of it. Although fainter, at the edge of her consciousness, there remained that ominous glow. "Shut it out, Chris." Chris took a deep breath and tried to focus on the book. She found her place and, grown impatient, started hastily flipping through its pages, skimming and searching for specific descriptions that would match Reagan's symptoms. "Demonic possession syndrome," she read. "Case of an 8-year-old girl. Abnormal. 4 strong men to restrain her from..." Turning the page, Chris froze. Then sounds. Willie entering the kitchen with groceries. "Willie?" Chris called out to her tonelessly, her eyes riveted to the book. "Yes, madam, I am here," Willie answered. She was setting down bags full of groceries on a white-tiled counter. Dull-eyed and expressionless, her voice flat, and with her slightly trembling fingers holding her place, Chris held up the partly closed witchcraft book, asking, "Willie, was it you put this book in the study?" Willie came a few steps closer, squinted at the book's cover, briefly nodded, and as she turned and started back toward the groceries, answered, "Yes, Mrs., yes, yes, I put it." "Willie, where did you find it?"
Up in bedroom," Willie answered, as she started slipping groceries out of the bags and onto the kitchen counter. Chris stared fixedly at the pages of the book, now back on the table and open to her place. "Which bedroom, Willie?"
"Miss Reagan bedroom, missus. I find it under bed when I am cleaning."
Her voice numb, her eyes wide and fixedly staring, Chris looked up and said, "When did you find it?"
"After all, go to hospital, madam, when I vacuum in Reagan bedroom."
"Willie, are you absolutely sure?"
"Yes, I am sure."
Chris looked down at the pages of the book, and for a time she did not move, did not blink, did not breathe, as the headlong image of an open window in Reagan's bedroom on the night of Denning's accident rushed at her memory with its talons extended like a bird of prey that knew her name. As she recognized the sight that was so numbingly familiar, as she stared at the right-hand page of the open book where a narrow strip had been shaved from the length of its edge, Chris jerked up her head. Some commotion in Reagan's bedroom, rappings, rapid and loud, and with a nightmarish resonance that was massive and yet somehow muffled, like a sledgehammer pounding at a limestone wall deep within some ancient tomb. Reagan screaming in anguish, in terror, imploring, Carl shouting angrily, fearfully, at Reagan. Chris bolted from the kitchen. "God almighty, what's happening? What?" Frenzied, Chris ran up the staircase, raced to the second floor, then toward Reagan's bedroom, when she heard a blow, someone reeling, someone crashing to the floor, and her daughter crying, "No! Oh, no, don't! Oh, no, please!" And Carl bellowing, "No, no, not Carl. Someone else with a deep bass voice that was threatening, that was raging." Chris plunged down the hall and burst into the bedroom, then gasped and stood rooted in paralyzing shock as the rappings boomed massively, shivering through walls, as Carl lay unconscious on the floor near the bureau, and as Reagan, with her legs propped up and spread wide on a bed that was violently bouncing and shaking, her eyes wide and bulging with terror, and a face smeared with blood that was dripping from her nose with a nasogastric tubing had been violently ripped out as she stared at a bone-white crucifix clutched and held poised in the air just above and aimed directly at Reagan's vagina. "Oh, please! Oh, no, please!" she was shrieking as her hands brought the crucifix closer while seeming to be straining to hold it back.
"You'll do as I tell you, you filth! You'll do it!"
The threatening bellow, the words came from Reagan in a voice coarse and guttural and bristling with venom, while in an instantaneous flash her expression and features hideously transmuted into those of the feral, demonic personality that had appeared in the course of hypnosis, and as Chris watched, stunned, both the faces and voices interchanged with rapidity.
"No! You'll do it! No, please, no! You will, you little bitch, or I'll kill you!"
And now the switch back to Reagan, with her eyes wide and staring, as if flinching from the rush of some hideous finality, her mouth agape and shrieking until, again, the demon personality possessed her, filled her, the room suddenly filling with a stench in the nostrils, with an icy cold that seemed to seep from the walls as the rapping sounds ended and Reagan's piercing cry of terror elided into a guttural, yelping laugh of malevolent spite triumphant, while she thrust down the crucifix into her vagina. Then again and again, as she masturbated with it ferociously while roaring in that deep, coarse, deafening voice,
"Now you're mine, you bitch, you stinking cow. Yes, let Jesus fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck you."
Chris stood rooted to the floor in horror, her hands pressing tightly against her cheeks, as again the demonic, loud laugh cackled joyously, as from Reagan's vagina her blood gushed onto white linen sheets. And then abruptly, with a shriek coming raw and clawing from her throat, Chris rushed at the bed, grasping blindly at the crucifix while her features contorting infernally. Reagan flared up at her in fury and, reaching out a hand, clutched Chris's hair and, powerfully yanking her head down, firmly pressed Chris's face against her vagina, smearing it with blood as Reagan undulated her pelvis. "Ah, little pig mother," Reagan crooned with a guttural eroticism. "Lick me, lick me, ah, lick me, ah." Then the hand that was holding Chris's head down jerked it upward, while the other arm smashed a blow across her chest that sent Chris reeling across the room and crashing to a wall with stunning force, while Reagan mockingly laughed. Chris crumpled to the floor in a daze of horror, in a swirling of images, of sounds in the room, as a vision spun, blurring, unfocused, her ears ringing loud with chaotic distortions as she weakly tried to raise herself, pushing up with her hands on the floor and faltering, looking toward the bed, toward Reagan with her back to her, thrusting the crucifix gently and sensually into her vagina, then out, then in, with that deep bass voice crooning, "Ah, there's my sow, yes, my sweet honey piglet." Chris started crawling painfully toward the bed, her face smeared with blood, her eyes still unfocused, limbs aching, and then cringe shrinking back in incredulous terror, as she thought she saw hazily, as if in an undulating fog, her daughter's head turning slowly and inexorably, completely around on a motionless torso, until at last Chris was looking directly into the fox-like, angry eyes of Burke Dennings.
"You know what she did, your cunting daughter?"
Chris screamed until she fainted. Part 3. The Abyss. Chapter 1. She was standing on the Keybridge walkway, arms atop the parapet, fidgeting, waiting, while homeward-bound traffic stuttered thickly behind her as drivers with everyday cares honked horns and bumpers nudged bumpers with scraping indifference. She had reached Mary Jo, told her lies.
Oh, yeah, Reagan's fine. By the way, I've been thinking of another little dinner party, Mary Jo. What was the name of that Jesuit psychiatrist again? I thought maybe I'd include him in...
Laughter floated up from below her. A blue-jeaned young couple in a rented canoe. With a quick, nervous gesture, she flicked ash from her cigarette, the last in her pack, and glanced up the walkway of the bridge toward the district. Someone hurrying toward her. Khaki pants, blue sweater. Not a priest. Not him. She looked down at the river again, at her helplessness swirling in the wake of the bright red canoe. She could make out the name on its side. Caprice. Footsteps. The man in the chinos and sweater coming closer, slowing down as he reached her. Peripherally, she saw him rest a forearm on the top of the parapet and quickly averted her gaze toward Virginia. Another autograph seeker, or worse, Chris McNeil. Flipping her cigarette butt into the river, Chris said coldly, "Keep moving or I swear I'll yell for a cop." "Miss McNeil, I'm Father Karras." Chris started, then reddened, jerking swiftly around to the chipped, rugged face. "Oh, my God, I'm so sorry." She was tugging at her sunglasses, flustered, then immediately pushing them back as the sad, dark eyes probed hers. "I should have told you that I wouldn't be in uniform." The voice was cradling, stripping her of burden. The priest had clasped his hands together on the parapet, veined Michelangelo's, sensitive and large. "I thought it would be much less conspicuous," he continued. "You seemed so concerned about keeping this quiet." "Guess I should have been concerned about not making such an ass of myself," Chris retorted. I just thought you were human," Karras finished with a faint, wry smile. Chris appraised him, and then, nodding and returning the smile, she said, "Yeah, yeah. I knew that the first time I saw you." "Oh, really? When was that?"
"On the campus one day while we were filming. You got a cigarette, Father?"
Karras reached into the pocket of his shirt. "Well, can you go a non-filter? Right now I'd smoke rope. My allowance, I frequently do." Smiling tightly, Chris nodded. "You're right. Valve poverty," she murmured. As she slipped out a cigarette from the packet the priest was holding out to her, Karras reached into a trouser pocket for matches. "A vow of poverty has its uses," he said. "Oh, really? Like what?" "Makes rope taste better." Again, a half smile, as he watched Chris's hand that was holding the cigarette. It was trembling, the cigarette wavering in quick, erratic jumps, and without pausing he took it from her fingers, put it up to his mouth, and, cupping his hands around the match, he lit the cigarette, puffed, and then gave it back to Chris, saying, "Awful lot of breeze from all these cars going by." Chris looked at him appraisingly, with gratitude, and even with hope, she knew what he'd done. "Thanks, Father," she said. And then she watched as he lit up a Camel for himself. He forgot to cup his hands. As he exhaled, they each leaned an elbow on the parapet.
So, where are you from, Father Karras? I mean, originally.
"Oh, New York."
"Yeah? Oh, me too."
"I would never go back, though, would you?" Karras fought down the rise in his throat. "No. No, I wouldn't." He forced a little smile. "But I don't have to make those decisions." Chris shook her head and looked aside. "God, I'm dumb," she said. "You're a priest.
Have to go where they send you.
Yeah, that's right.
Hey, how does Shrink ever get to be a priest? He was anxious to know what the urgent problem was that she'd mentioned when she'd called him at the residence. He was feeling her way, he sensed, but toward what?
He must not prod. It would come. It's the other way around, he corrected her gently. The society...
Who?
The Society of Jesus. Jesuit is short for that.
Oh, I see.
The society sent me through medical school and through psychiatric training.
Oh, really? Where?
Oh, well, Harvard, Johns Hopkins, places like that.
He was suddenly aware that he wanted to impress her. Why, he wondered, and immediately saw the answer in the slums of his boyhood, in the balconies of theaters on the Lower East Side,
little Dimmy with the movie star.
Chris nodded her head in approval.
Not bad, she said.
Yeah,
we don't take vows of mental poverty.
She sensed a subtle irritation, shrugged, turned front, facing out to the river.
Look, it's just that I don't know you, and...
She dragged on the cigarette long and deep, then exhaled, crushing out the butt on the parapet, and then flipping it out to the river. You're a friend of Father Dyer, is that right?
Yes, yes, I am.
Pretty close?
Pretty close.
Did he talk about my party?
At your house?
Yeah, at my house.
Yeah, he said you seemed human.
She missed it,
or ignored it.
Did he talk about my daughter?
No, I didn't know you had one.
She's 12. He didn't mention her?
No.
He didn't tell you what she did?
He never mentioned her.
Priests keep a pretty tight mouth then, that right?
Well, that depends, answered Garris.
On what?
On the priest.
At the fringe of the Jesuit's awareness drifted a warning about women with neurotic attractions to priests, women who desired, unconsciously and under the guise of some other problem, to seduce the unattainable. Look, I mean like confession. You're not allowed to talk about it, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And outside of confession, she asked him, I mean, what if some, her hands were now agitated, fluttering. I'm curious.
No, I'd really like to know. I mean, what if a person, let's say, was a criminal, like maybe a murderer or something, you know?
If he came to you for help, would you have to turn him in?
Let's see. Seeking instruction, he wondered. Was she clearing off doubts in the way of conversion?
There were people, Karis knew, who approached salvation as if it were at the end of a flimsy bridge overhanging an abyss.
Well, if he came to me for spiritual help, I'd say no, he answered.
You wouldn't turn him in.
No, I wouldn't. But I'd try to persuade him to turn himself in.
Ah, and so, how do you go about getting an exorcism?
There was a pause while Karis stared at her.
I beg your pardon, he said at last. If a person's possessed by some kind of demon, how do you go about getting an exorcism?
Karis looked off, took a breath, and looked back to her. Oh, well, first you'd have to put him in a time machine and get him back to the 16th century.
Puzzled, Chris frowned. What do you mean?
Well, it just doesn't happen anymore.
Oh, really? Since when?
Since when? Since we learned about mental illness and schizophrenia and split personality, all those things that they taught me at Harvard.
Are you kidding me?
Chris's voice had wavered, sounding helpless, confused. And instantly, Karis regretted his flipness. Where had it come from, he wondered. It had leaped to his tongue, unbidden. Many educated Catholics, he said in a gentler tone, don't believe in the devil anymore.
And as far as possession is concerned, since the day I joined the Jesuits, I've never met a priest who's
ever in his life performed an exorcism. Not one.
Oh, are you really a priest, or are you from Central Casting? Chris blurted with a suddenly bitter, disappointed sharpness.
I mean, what about all those stories in the Bible about Christ driving out all those demons?
Karis answered spontaneously with heat.
Look, if Christ had said those people who were supposedly possessed had schizophrenia, which I imagine they did, they would have probably crucified him 3 years earlier. Oh, really?
Chris put a shaking hand to her sunglasses, deepening her voice in an effort at control.
Well, it happens, Father Karis, that someone very close to me is probably possessed and needs an exorcism. Will you do it?
To Karis, it suddenly seemed unreal. Key Bridge, motor traffic, across the river, the hot shop with frozen milkshakes, and beside him a movie star asking for an exorcism? As he stared at her, groping for an answer, she slipped off her oversized dark sunglasses, and Karis felt a wincing shock at the redness, at the desperate pleading in those haggard eyes, and suddenly realized that the woman was serious.
Father Karis, it's my daughter. It's my daughter.
Then all the more reason, he said to her soothingly, to forget about an exorcism.
Why?
Chris suddenly burst out in a voice that was cracking and strident and distraught.
Tell me, why? God, I don't understand.
Karis took hold of her wrist in an effort to calm her. In the first place, he told her, it could make things worse. Incredulous, Chris scrunched up her face and said,
worse?
Yes, worse, that's right. Because the ritual of exorcism is dangerously suggestive. It could implant the notion of possession where it didn't exist before. Or if it did, it could tend to fortify it.
But secondly,
please, listen to me. Secondly, before the Catholic Church approves an exorcism, it conducts an investigation to see if it's warranted. And that takes time. In the meantime, couldn't you do it yourself? Chris's lower lip was slightly trembling now, her eyes filling up with tears.
Look, every priest has the power to exorcise, but he has to have church approval. And frankly, it's rarely ever given, so can't you even look at her?
Well, as a psychiatrist, I could.
She needs a priest!
Chris cried out suddenly, her features contorting with anger and fear. I've taken her to every goddamn fucking doctor psychiatrist in the world, and they sent me to you. Now you send me to them?
Jesus Christ, would somebody help me?
The heart-stopping shriek bolted raw above the river, sending startled flocks of birds shooting up into the air from its grassy banks with the sound of cawing and a thousand flapping wings.
Oh, my God, would someone help me?
Chris moaned as, sobbing convulsively, she crumpled to Karis's chest.
Oh, please. Help me, please.
The Jesuit looked down at her and then lifted up comforting hands to her head as the riders in traffic-locked automobiles glanced out windows to watch them with passing disinterest.
It's all right, Karis told her. He wanted only to calm her, to stem her hysteria.
My daughter? No, it was Chris who needed psychiatric help. He believed.
It's all right. I'll go see her, he told her. I'll see her right now. Come on, let's go.
With that sense of unreality still lingering, Karis let her lead him to the house in silence and with thoughts of his next day's lecture at the Georgetown Medical School. He had yet to prepare his notes. As they climbed the front stoop, Karis glanced at his watch. It was 6:10. He looked down the street at the Jesuit residence hall as he realized he would now miss dinner.
Father Karis?
The priest turned to look at Chris. About to turn her key in the front door lock, she had hesitated and turned to him.
Do you think you should be wearing your priest clothes? She said.
Karis eyed her with a pity that he tried to conceal. Her face and her voice, how helplessly childlike they were.
Too dangerous, he told her.
Okay. Chris turned back and started opening the door. And it was then that Karis felt it. A chill, tugging warning. It scraped through his bloodstream like particles of ice.
Father Karis?
He looked up. Chris had entered the house. For a hesitant moment, the priest stood unmoving. Then, slowly and deliberately, as if he had made a decision to do so, he went forward, stepping into the house with an odd sense of ending. Karis heard commotion. Upstairs, a deep, booming voice was thundering obscenities, threatening in anger and in hate and frustration. Taken aback, he turned to Chris with a look of wonderment. She was staring at him mutely. Then she moved on ahead. He followed her upstairs and along a hall to where Carl was standing with his head bent low over folded arms, just opposite the door to Reagan's bedroom. At this close range, the voice from the bedroom was so loud that it almost seemed amplified electronically. As Carl looked up at their approach, the priest saw bafflement, fright in his eyes, as in an awed and cracking voice he said to Chris, "It wants no straps." Chris turned to Karis. "I'll be back in a second," she told him, the words coming dully from a worn-out soul. Karis watched her as she turned and walked away down the hall and then into her bedroom. She left the door wide open behind her. Karis turned his glance to Carl. The houseman was staring at him intently.
"You a priest?"
he asked.
Karis nodded,
then looked quickly back to Reagan's bedroom door. The raging voice had been abruptly displaced by the long, strident lowing of some animal that might have been a steer. Something prodding at Karis's hand. He looked down.
"That's her," Chris was saying. "That's Reagan." She was handing him a photograph, and he took it.
A young girl.
Very pretty. Sweet smile.
"That was taken 4 months ago," Chris said dreamily. She took back the photo and motioned with her head at the bedroom door. "Now you go and take a look at her now." Chris leaned back against the wall beside Carl. With her eyes cast down, her arms folded across her chest, she said hopelessly and quietly, "I'll wait here."
"Who's in there with her?" Karis asked.
Chris looked up at him, expressionless.
"No one."
The priest held her haunted gaze, and then turned with a frown to the bedroom door, and as he grasped the doorknob, the sounds from within abruptly ceased. In the ticking silence, Karis hesitated, then slowly entered the room, almost flinching backward at the pungent stench of moldering excrement that hit his face and his nostrils like a palpable blast. Reining in his revulsion, he closed the door, and then his eyes locked, stunned, on the thing that was Reagan, on the creature that was lying on its back on the bed, head propped against a pillow, while eyes bulging wide in their hollow sockets shone with mad cunning and burning intelligence, with interest and with spite, as they fixed upon his, as they watched him intently, seething in a face shaped into a skeletal mask of unthinkable malevolence. Karis shifted his gaze to the tangled and thickly matted hair, to the wasted arms and legs, and distended stomach jutting up so grotesquely. Then back to the eyes. They were watching him, pinning him,
shifting now to follow as he moved to a desk and chair near the large bay window. Karis fought to sound calm, even warm and friendly. "Hello, Reagan," he said. He picked up the chair and took it over by the bed. "I'm a friend of your mother's," he said, "and she tells me that you're very, very sick." Karis sat down. "Do you think you'd like to tell me what's wrong?" he asked. "I'd like to help you." Reagan's eyes gleamed fiercely, unblinking, as the yellowish saliva dribbled down from a corner of her mouth to her chin, to her lips stretched taut into a feral grin of bow-mouthed mockery. "Well, well, well," she gloated sardonically, and hairs prickled up on the back of Karis's neck at a voice that was deep and thick with menace and power. "So it's you. They sent you," she continued as if pleased. "Well, we've nothing to fear from you at all." "Yes, yes, that's right," Karis answered. "I'm your friend. I told you I'm your mother's friend. And I would like to help you." "Well, you might loosen these straps then," Reagan croaked. She had tugged up her wrists so that now Karis noticed they were bound with a double set of leather restraining straps.
"Are the straps uncomfortable for you?"
"Yes, extremely. They're a nuisance, an infernal nuisance." The eyes glinted slyly with secret amusement. Karis saw the scratch marks on Reagan's face, the cuts on her lips where apparently she'd bitten them. I'm afraid you might hurt yourself, Reagan," he told her.
"I'm not Reagan," she rumbled, still with that taut and hideous grin that Karis now guessed was a permanent expression. How incongruous the braces on her teeth looked. "Oh, I see," he said, nodding. "Well, then, maybe we should introduce ourselves. I'm Damien Karis. Who are you?"
"I'm the devil."
"Oh, good," Karis nodded approvingly. "Now we can talk."
"Oh, a little chat?"
"Oh, if you wish."
"Oh, yes, I would like that," Reagan said, drooling a little from a corner of her mouth. "However, you'll find that I cannot talk freely while bound with these straps. As you know, I've spent much of my time in Rome, and I'm accustomed to gesturing, Karis. Now then, kindly, undo the straps."
What precocity of language and thought, reflected Karis. He leaned forward in his chair with a mixture of amazement and professional interest.
"You say you're the devil?" he asked.
"I assure you."
"Well then, why don't you just make the straps disappear?"
"Oh, come, that's much too vulgar a display of power, Karis. After all, I'm a prince. The prince of this world, as some very strange person said of me once. Can't remember quite who." "I much prefer persuasion, Karis. Togetherness, community, involvement. Moreover, if I loosen the straps myself, I deny you the opportunity of performing a charitable act." "Incredible," thought Karis.
"But a charitable act," he parried, "is a virtue. And that's what the devil would want to prevent. So, in fact, I'd be helping you now if I didn't undo the straps. Oh, well, I mean, unless, of course," Karis shrugged, "unless, of course, you really aren't the devil, and in that case, I probably would undo them."
"How very foxy of you, Karis. If only dear Herod were here to enjoy this."
Karis stared with narrowed eyes and an even deeper interest. Was she punning
on Christ's calling Herod that fox? Which Herod, he asked. There were two. Are you talking about the king of Judea?
No, I am talking about the Tetrarch of Galilee!
Reagan shot back at Karras, and a voice raised to blast him with scorching contempt. Then abruptly she was grinning again, as she quietly cajoled in that soft and sinister voice.
There you see how these damnable straps have upset me. Undo them, Karras.
Undo them, and I'll tell you the future.
That's very tempting. Eh? My forte.
Yeah, but how do I know you really can read the future?
Because I'm the devil, you ass. Yes, you say so.
But you won't give me proof.
You have no faith.
Karras stiffened, paused. No faith in what?
Why, in me, my dear Karras. In me. Something mocking and malicious danced hidden in those eyes. All these proofs, all these signs in the sky.
Karras barely had a grip on his composure as he answered,
well, now something very simple might do. For example, the devil knows everything, right? No. In fact, I know almost everything, Karras. There you see, they keep saying that I am proud. I'm not. Now then, what are you up to, sly fox? Spit it out.
Well, I thought we might test the extent of your knowledge.
Very well, then. How's this? The largest lake in South America, the Reagan thing japed, her eyes bulging with mocking glee, is Lake Titicaca in Peru. Will that do it?
No. I'll have to ask something only the devil would know.
Ah, I see. Such as what?
Well, where is Reagan?
She is here.
Where is here?
In the piglet.
Well, then let me see her.
Why, Karras? Do you want to fuck her?
Loose these straps and I'll let you go at it.
I want to see if you're telling me the truth. Let me see her. She's a poor conversationalist, my friend. I strongly advise you to stay with me.
Well, it's obvious to me you don't know where she is. Karras shrugged. So, apparently you aren't the devil.
I am!
Well, then let me see Reagan. I mean, that would prove it.
There are much better ways. I will show you. I will read your mind. The Reagan creature seethed furiously. Think of a number between 1 and 100.
Come on, that wouldn't prove a thing. I'd have to see Reagan. Abruptly, it chuckled, leaning back against the headboard.
No. No, nothing would prove anything at all to you, Karras. That is why I love all reasonable men. Oh, how splendid. How splendid indeed. In the meantime, we shall try to keep you properly beguiled. After all, we wouldn't wish to lose you.
Who is we? Karras probed with a quick, alert interest.
Oh, we are quite a little group in the piglet, came the answer. Oh, yes, quite a little multitude. Later I may see about discreet introductions. In the meantime, I am suffering from a maddening itch that I cannot reach. Would you loosen one strap for a moment? Just one.
No. Just tell me where it itches, and I'll scratch it.
Sly. Very, very sly.
Listen, let's quit kidding around. You show me Reagan, and perhaps I'll undo one strap, offered Karras. I mean, that's for fighting, she's...
Abruptly, the priest flinched in shock
as he found himself staring into eyes filled with terror, and a mouth gaping wide and a soundless shriek for help. But then quickly the Reagan identity vanished in a blurringly rapid remolding of features as,
"For pity's sakes, would you kindly remove these cunting straps?"
asked the wheedling voice in a clipped British accent, just before, in a flash, the demonic personality returned.
"Could you help an old altar boy, father?" it croaked, and as it threw back its head in wild and high-pitched laughter.
Stunned, Karras leaned back, as he felt the glacial hands at the back of his neck again, more palpable now, and more clearly something more than suggestion. The Reagan thing broke off its laughter and fixed him with taunting eyes.
"Feeling icy hands, Karras?"
"Oh, incidentally, your mother is in here with us, Karras. Would you like to leave a message?"
"I'll see that she gets it." Mocking laughter, and then suddenly Karras was leaping out of his chair as he dodged a projectile stream of vomit. It caught a portion of a sweater and one of his hands.
His face drained of color, the priest looked down at the bed, at Reagan cackling with glee as his hand dripped vomit onto the rug.
"If that's true," he said numbly,
"then you must know my mother's first name."
"Oh, I do."
"Well, what is it?"
The Reagan thing hissed at him, mad eyes gleaming, and the head gently undulating from side to side like a cobra's.
"What is it?" Karras repeated,
with her eyes rolling upward into their sockets. Reagan lowed like a steer in an angry bellow that pierced the shutters and shivered through the glass of the large bay window.
For a time, Karras watched as the bellowing continued. Then he looked at his hand and walked out of the room. Chris pushed herself quickly away from the wall as she glanced with distress at the Jesuit's sweater.
"Oh, what happened? Oh, God, did she vomit?"
"You got a towel?" Karras asked her. "There's a bathroom right there," Chris said hurriedly, pointing at a hallway door.
"Carl, go and take a look at her,"
she instructed over her shoulder as she followed the priest to the bathroom.
"I'm so sorry."
The Jesuit moved to the wash basin.
"Have you got her on tranquilizers?" he asked.
Chris turned on the water taps and answered, "Yes, yes, Librium. Here, take that sweater off, and then you can wash."
"What dosage?" Karras asked, as he tugged at the sweater with his clean left hand.
"Hey, wait a second, I'll help you." Chris pulled at the sweater from the bottom.
"Well, today she's had 400 milligrams, father."
400? Chris had the sweater pulled up to his chest.
"Yeah, that's how we got her into those straps.
It took all of us together."
"You gave your daughter 400 milligrams at once?"
"Father, she's so strong you can't believe it. Get your arms up, please."
"Okay."
He raised them, and Chris pulled the sweater up and off, pulled back the shower curtain, and tossed the sweater into the bathtub. "I'll have Willie get it clean for you, father." She dejectedly sat down on the edge of the bathtub and slipped a pink towel off a towel bar, her hand inadvertently covering the word Reagan, embroidered in navy blue script.
"I'm just so sorry," she said.
"Never mind, doesn't matter." Karras unbuttoned the right sleeve of his starched white shirt and rolled it up, exposing a matting of fine brown hairs on the thickly muscled forearm, as he asked, "Is she taking any nourishment at all?"
He held his hand underneath the hot water tap to rinse away the vomit.
"No, father. The sausage, I mean, when she's sleeping, but she ripped out the tubing."
"She ripped it out? When?"
"Today."
Disturbed, Karras soaped and rinsed his hands, and after a thoughtful pause, he said gravely, You know, your daughter really needs to be in a hospital. Chris lowered her head. I just can't do that, Father, she said, in a soft, flat, toneless voice. Why can't you?
I just can't, Chris repeated, in a husky, dead whisper. She's done something, Father, and I can't take the risk of someone else finding out. Not a doctor, not a nurse, no, not anyone. Frowning, Karis turned off the water taps and recollected.
What if a person, let's say, was a criminal?
Troubled, he looked down at the wash basin, gripping its sides. Who's been giving her the sustagen? The Librium, her medicines?
We are. Her doctor showed us how.
You need prescriptions.
But you could do some of that, couldn't you, Father?
His thoughts now spinning. Karis turned to her, his hands upraised, as he met Chris's haunted, vanquished gaze.
He nodded toward the towel in her hands and said, Please.
Chris stared at him blankly and said, What?
Towel, please.
I'm sorry. Very quickly, Chris fumbled it out to him. And as the Jesuit dried his hands, she asked him with a tightly searching expectancy, So now, Father, what's it look like? Do you think she's possessed?
Look, how much do you know about possession?
I don't know. Just a little that I've read and some things that some doctors told me.
Doctors? What doctors?
At Barringer Clinic?
I see.
Karis nodded his head. He had folded the towel and was carefully draping it back onto the towel bar as he asked, Miss McNeil, are you a Catholic?
No, I'm not. And your daughter?
No, not her either.
Well, what religion then?
None. Karis stared at her speculatively.
Why did you come to me then?
Because I was desperate, Chris blurted in a quavering voice. I thought you told me psychiatrists advised you to come to me.
Well, I don't know what I was saying. I've been practically out of my head.
Karis turned and, folding his arms and leaning his weight against the wash basin's white marble counter, he looked down at Chris and told her with a carefully tempered intensity,
Look, the only thing I care about is doing what's best for your daughter. But I'll tell you right now that if you're looking for an exorcism as an autosuggestive cure, you'd have been much better off if you had gone to Central Casting, Miss McNeil, because Catholic Church authorities aren't going to buy it, and you'll have wasted precious time.
Karis felt his hands trembling slightly. What's wrong with me, he wondered. What's happening?
Incidentally, it's Mrs. McNeil, Chris corrected him tautly.
Karis gentled his tone.
My apology.
Look, whether it's a demon or a mental disorder, I'll do everything I possibly can to help your daughter. But I have got to have the truth, the whole truth. It's important. It's important for Reagan, Mrs. McNeil, because right now I'm groping. I'm completely overwhelmed by what I've just seen and heard in your daughter's bedroom. Now, can we both get out of this bathroom and go downstairs where we can really talk?
With a faint, warm smile of reassurance, Karis reached out his hand to help Chris up.
I could really use a good cup of coffee. I could really use a sea and ski on the rocks.
While Carl and Sharon looked after Reagan, Karis and Chris sat in the study, she on the sofa and Karis in a chair beside the fireplace. As Chris went through the history of Reagan's illness, though she carefully withheld any mention of phenomena relating to Dennings. The priest listened, saying little, an occasional question, a nod, or frown, as Chris admitted that at first she'd considered an exorcism as shock treatment. But now, how, I don't know. I don't know, she said. Shaking her head, she looked down at her freckled, clasped fingers, subtly twitching in her lap. Father, God, I don't know. She lifted a helpless look to the priest. What do you think, Father? Lowering his head, the priest took in a breath, shook his head, and said quietly, I don't know either. Compulsive behavior produced by guilt, perhaps? Put together with split personality?
What?
Chris looked appalled.
Father, how can you say that? After all you've just seen up there.
Karis looked up at her. If you've seen as many patients in psychiatric wards as I have, you can say it very easily, he said. Come on now. Possession by demons? Okay, listen. Let's assume it's a fact, and that it sometimes happens.
But your daughter doesn't say she's a demon. She insists she's the devil himself. That's the same thing as saying you're Napoleon Bonaparte.
Okay. Okay, then explain all those rappings and things. I haven't heard them. Well, they heard them at Barringer, Father, so it wasn't just here in the house. Maybe so, but we'd hardly need a devil to explain them.
Oh, really?
So explain them. Well, psychokinesis, maybe.
What?
Well, you've heard of poltergeist phenomena, haven't you? Ghosts throwing dishes and acting like assholes? It's not that uncommon and usually happens around an emotionally disturbed adolescent. Apparently, extreme inattention of the mind can sometimes trigger some unknown energy that seems to move objects around at a distance. But there's nothing supernatural about it. Same with Reagan's abnormal strength. Pathology that's common. Call it mind over matter if you like, but it happens outside of possession. Chris looked away, slightly shaking her head. Boy, isn't this beautiful, she said with weary irony. Here I am, the atheist, and here you are, a priest. And the best explanation for any phenomenon, Karis gently told her, is always the simplest one available that accommodates all the facts.
Oh, really?
Chris retorted. In her red-veined eyes, a look of pleading and despair and confusion. Oh, well, maybe I'm dumb, Father Karis. But telling me some unknown gizmo in somebody's head throw dishes at a wall seems to me even dumber. So what is it? Can you tell me what it is? And what split personality, anyway? I mean, you say it. I hear it. What the fuck is it? Am I really that stupid? Will you tell me what the fuck it is in a way that I can finally get it through my head?
Look, there's no one who pretends to understand it. All we know is that it happens. And anything beyond the phenomenon itself is just pure speculation. It's guesswork.
But think of it this way, if you like. Yeah? Go ahead. The human brain contains something like 17 billion cells. And when we look at them, we see that they handle approximately 100 million sensations that are bombarding your brain every second. And your brain not only integrates all of those messages, they do it efficiently, they do it without ever stumbling or getting in each other's way. Now then, how could they do that without some form of communication? Well, they couldn't. So apparently, each of these cells has a consciousness, maybe, of its own. Are you still